Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop committed to sustainable practices and organic, ethically sourced coffee from small-scale farmers. Featuring handmade quiche, scones, and baked goods. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
The recipe is unique to what desired melt we want, what desired mouthfeel we're looking for, and the ratio of those ingredients is going to dictate that.
This week, in honor of Valentine's Day, we visit a chocolate factory and learn how the fruit of the cacao tree is transformed into a silky bar of chocolate. And not just any chocolate, fair trade chocolate. We speak with the CEO of Fair Trade America about what it means to be fair trade certified. We've also got a chocolate cake recipe that almost anyone can bake. You could make it for your Valentine. That's all just ahead, so stay tuned. During the week of Valentine's Day, Americans will purchase more than 50 million pounds of chocolate. If you want to make sure the sweets you pick out for your sweetheart aren't supporting child labor practices or exploiting small farmers, you might want to look for a fair trade mark on the back of that heart-shaped box. I spoke with Hans Thayer, the CEO of Fair Trade America, to find out what specifically the fair trade mark stands for.
Fair trade is a development model in which most of the work tries to accomplish three things. One is to increase the income of farming families. The second is trying to help them establish commercial and business relationships with companies around the world in what we call fairer terms, in which they can be decision makers. And three is opening the spaces for consumers to understand the realities that farmers face and to have farmers speak on their own about what they're living, about their aspirations, and about their dreams. So we try to put all these actors together. We set a fair trade minimum price for commodities, which is a good approximation of production costs. And on top of that, the premium, which is an extra amount that companies contribute to the farming community so they themselves can choose what to do with those monies. And they're usually spent in social projects like having access to better education for their kids or better health or water systems, and to help them strengthen their cooperatives as well. The way that companies show consumers that they're engaging small farmers in these fairer terms of trade is they use a mark, a certification, and farmers themselves are audited and get certified to ensure that they're complying, for example, with environmental standards, proper stewardship of nature, of resources, that they produce without having child labor, which, as you know, is a big epidemic, I'm afraid, in cocoa, and that they're producing under those standards as well. So both sides are audited by a third-party company. So they ensure that A, producers are producing under fair trade terms, and that businesses are buying and selling under fair trade terms.
That minimum price is important. It means that even if cocoa prices fluctuate, farmers can count on being paid a certain price, and that price will at least cover their costs for production. Lately, market prices for cocoa have been so volatile. Cocoa prices fell 30% last year. So that minimum price has been crucial for farmers to simply stay afloat. Fairtrade also includes a premium, which is something like profit sharing that companies pay to farmers and to farm co-ops.
They choose what to do with that premium. Usually is used for social purposes, and sometimes a percentage of it can be withdrawn if they all agree as cash, and that would be complementing their income as cash.
But Fairtrade works with other organizations to address more than mere subsistence in these communities.
Unfortunately, with the current prices of cocoa, poverty is still rampant. At Fairtrade, we look at minimum prices, but the next step is to analyze and benchmark what a living income looks like for a family. What we're aiming at now is not just the minimum price, but also how we and other actors can support families get to a living income.
Hans Thayer traveled to the Ivory Coast with Kurt Vandermeer in 2016. He's the CEO of Endangered Species, one of the fair trade chocolate companies.
He not just wants to do the best chocolate, he also understands how by doing business in a different way, he can really have such a profound impact in families, not just this generation, but future generations.
Next, we visit Endangered Species Chocolate Company in Indianapolis to learn how they produce their chocolate bars with these fair trade sourced cocoa beans. Coming up in just a moment. Production support for Earth Eats comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. To learn about the entire bean-to-bar process of fair trade chocolate, I paid a visit to the Endangered Species Chocolate Company in Indianapolis. Whitney Bembenick is the Director of Innovation and my tour guide.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Kate Young. I'm here to see Whitney.
That's me. Oh,
hi. She led me into a windowed hallway overlooking the chocolate factory floor. It's lined with storyboards describing all of the chocolate-making steps. We start with the most important step for fair trade chocolate, the sourcing. All of their cocoa comes from farmers certified through the fair trade process.
Our cacao comes from the Côte d'Ivoire. Cocoa can only thrive, 10 degrees north and south of the equator. And so West Africa has this really rich soil that is perfect for growing a premium cacao. And that Theobroma cacao tree has been growing in that region for centuries. Cacao, the word, is abbreviated from the Theobroma cacao. That's the tree that cacao pods are growing on. There's an image in front of you, and this is a really young pod that is just a beautiful lime green color, and it's no bigger than heel to fingertip of my hand, so 5 to 6 inches long. By the time it reaches maturity, that pod has grown to nearly the size of a football. And it's become this beautiful kind of red, orange, yellow, ripened fruit. And that pod, when you slice it open, is going to have anywhere from 50 to 75 cocoa beans inside of it, enrobed in this fibrous pulp that's white. So when you really crack it open, it does look like a fruit. I think people forget that the cacao is truly a fruit, but it looks like a fruit. And what the farmers have to do is they have to take these beans that are wet and mushy because of this pulp, and they need to dry them out. That drying is actually a fermentation process. So over the course of time, the beans are being rotated, they're being folded, and that pulp is drying and running off through fermentation. What's left are what we then bring over into the United States to process into chocolate. The first step that our processor is going to do is clean and sort the beans. You're gonna see, if you're familiar with coffee, this is a lot like the first steps of also roasting coffee. So the beans are clean and sorted, and this allows any debris to be cleaned out. Those beans are also tested for their fat content, and for endangered species chocolate, we have a targeted fat content that we're looking for in order to then produce our cocoa butter and cocoa liqueur that's going to go into the actual solid chocolate bars that we sell. And so that's part of the quality testing that begins the process of our specific recipe to make our chocolate. Once that's done, the beans are roasted. This is where I say we're starting to look a little bit like we're making coffee. The beans are roasted, and this again is a step in our recipe. Each chocolate manufacturer has their unique time and temperature that they're roasting at, and that roasting loosens the hull or the shell of the bean so that we can get to the heart of cocoa, which is the cocoa nib. So the cocoa nib is no bigger than like the blunt tip of a pencil. And that cocoa nib is what all things chocolate are going to be derived from. The nibs are crushed in order to create cocoa mass. And that cocoa mass is where we're going to continue adding pressure to extract the cocoa butter, the fat portion of the nib, and then reserve the cocoa solids. And that cocoa solid is where you're going to either make cocoa powder or you're going to then make cocoa liqueur. So we do cocoa butter and then we do cocoa liqueur, and those two constituents come together to make the total percent of cocoa in all of our recipes. So we have a 48% milk chocolate, we have a 60% dark chocolate, a 72% dark chocolate, and then our best-selling product, which is an 88% dark chocolate. Those numbers equal the total amount of cocoa solids that are in each of our chocolate bars. Each company is a little different. So our 88% dark chocolate bar actually doesn't contain cocoa butter. We only use cocoa liqueur to get to those cocoa solids. The remainder of our products do have that cocoa butter in it. And so the recipe is unique to what desired melt we want, what desired mouthfeel we're looking for, and the ratio of those ingredients is going to dictate that. The final step, once we've started taking that cocoa liqueur and cocoa butter, is to add the rest of the stuff that we need to put in order to make it a chocolate bar. And for our dark chocolate, all that's left is sugar, vanilla, and a non-GMO soy lecithin. And the cocoa liqueur, people are confused because they sometimes think liqueur is liquor, but it's not. It's just making it into a liquid cocoa constituent. So it's a very rich, almost like if you were to look at it, you would think like a molasses or a syrup, because it's this really thickened, syrupy look. But the other ingredients added to it, sometimes sugar is added, sometimes not. Sometimes it's just heat. The true cocoa liqueur is only made from cocoa. There are cases in which that's, for us it's not, for us it's only made from cocoa. The process of taking chocolate and taking the chocolate components and making it into what we know as a palatable chocolate is adding those other ingredients that we've been discussing, the sugar, the vanilla, and the emulsifier. There are a variety of types of emulsifiers. We choose to use soy lecithin because it allows us to have the smoothest chocolate bar. If you've had an endangered species chocolate bar, you know that it's exceptionally smooth. You don't get a lot of high granulation in the texture of the bite or the melt in that chocolate. And so while there could be alternatives, there's a sunflower lecithin that some chocolate companies have started to use, and other chocolate companies have decided to take it out completely. What that is doing is creating either a little bit less smooth bar because sunflower isn't as ideal, or if you don't add it at all, it is going to be more granular by nature. You can force that with the step that we're going to talk about here. You can force particle size to be reduced, but at the end of the day, having that emulsifier to bind your ingredients is what's creating that smooth profile. Because if you don't have it, eventually all of these things we've forced to come together don't want to be together anymore. The natural progression of, for instance, chocolate bloom on a shelf is just the natural process of cocoa butter saying, I don't want to be with all these other ingredients around me, so I'm going to try to rise to the surface of a chocolate bar. That's why it's white. It's actually the cocoa butter that is in that chocolate bar coming out to the surface of the bar. And it can be accelerated by a lot of things, but it naturally happens to chocolate as it sits and ages.
So by bloom, you're talking about that kind of white, little bit of a film that you might see on chocolate when you open it, or when it's been sitting in your, or if you put it in your fridge or something like that.
Bloom can be accelerated or antagonized by a lot of things. You mentioned putting it in your refrigerator. It's taking it out of the refrigerator and having that temperature swing, and then the condensation build up because moisture is chocolate's enemy that will accelerate bloom. Or on the opposite end of the spectrum, if it becomes too warm, because what we're going to learn about when we go out to the production floor is that as much as chocolate is an art, it's also a science, and it is very temperature dependent. So as I was training to learn how to work with chocolate, it was temperature. You're constantly trying to target these ideal temperatures at which the fat structure of chocolate is changing and evolving. And so as you change the temperature of a solid chocolate bar, you are altering its makeup, its structure, its fat base. And that is where then things like chocolate bloom can occur.
Okay. So anybody who has tried to make truffles at home and needs to temper chocolate might have a familiarity with this.
Correct. And there's a lot of variables that can impact that. So the level of cocoa butter, the viscosity, which is impacted by conching. So conching is the process of taking and folding these ingredients together to reduce the particle size and emulsify your liquid chocolate. And so during that process, this is when everything is coming together harmoniously and we have a beautiful, luscious chocolate that's ready to be tempered and finished. And the process of tempering, as you mentioned, is bringing that chocolate into a working temperature, which is formalizing the crystalline structure, which is a beta 5 crystalline structure. You're formalizing that structure to where it's ready to be worked with. And then once you get it done, you don't want to mess with it because you don't want to break that structure apart that you've built. So our processor actually does this for us and puts it into 10-pound blocks and puts those 10-pound blocks on large pallets and ships it to us here at Endangered Species, where we are now going to melt that down, retemper it, add the inclusions like our sea salt and almond bar or our cranberry almond or our raspberries, and then make it into the 3-ounce bar that we sell on shelf, which is one of the more common ways that chocolate's made in the United States. There are bean-to-bar manufacturers in the U.S. They are more rare than common because the process taking from the cacao pod to here is a very specialized and unique industry that people spend their whole life becoming experts in.
At this point, we donned our hairnets and headed onto the factory floor. We skirted around the periphery, so I couldn't see as much of the chocolate bar production as I had hoped for, but Whitney walked me through the basic steps.
So on the far wall, those pallets are what our chocolate come in on. We have 4 different recipes that come in on these pallets, and then we have a melt tank farm that all day long we're adding that chocolate into and melting the chocolate down. So each of our chocolates is melted at about 110 degrees. And what that is doing is it's liquefying the chocolate so it can be worked with, but it's also breaking down the beta 5 crystalline structure that is regularly causing that formed chocolate bar that we know. So as that fat structure is melted down, we start the process of tempering. No matter your cocoa content, you have crystallization at 94 degrees. And that crystallization is being developed through the process of cooling the chocolate down and seeding it with a solid crystalline structure. So we're actually reintroducing formed beta 5 crystalline into that chocolate at 94 degrees in order to establish your fat structure. If you think about, you have a ladder and you have rungs on the ladder, what you're doing is you're getting all the components together and you have all that you need at 94 degrees. Where each chocolate starts to differ is the temperature that you're then going to go to in order to work with that specific product. So we go through large temperers. They're constantly giving us temperature readouts to know what our chocolate temperature is, how far we are away from temper, and when it's ready to be sent into the depositor. So through a series of transfer pipes, the chocolate comes over to the depositor where we then add our inclusions. Today, it looks like we're on line 2, and that's our dark chocolate with organic caramel and pink Himalayan salt. So the 60% dark chocolate comes over. Depending on the cocoa content, you're going to have a set working temperature. And what that's telling you is these components of the ladder that you've built at 94 degrees are starting to assemble. For our highest cocoa content, we're going to work with it at 88 to 89 degrees because the ladder is set, it's ready. If you were to work with it when it's too warm, you don't have all the rungs on the ladder.
If you were to work with it after that temperature, you're starting to break it apart. And so what that translates to on shelf is a poorly tempered or a chocolate that's been worked with at the wrong temperature could have a dull appearance, it could have a chewy texture, and it could also bloom more quickly if those temperatures are not critical to the operation. We are able to produce roughly 35,000 chocolate bars per line per shift. So we currently are running one production shift Monday through Friday, sometimes Saturday. But these three lines together are really pumping out a lot of chocolate for us. I think when people see like a big brand that's on shelf, they don't really think about what goes into actually making each one of the chocolate bars, what goes into making that product. So this is Alejandro. He has our pink salt that he is weighing out for a specific recipe that we've created. He's mixing it in to our organic liquid caramel. And what he'll do with that is he'll take it over into the depositing area and he'll take that bucket and mix it into the top depositor so that it can be deposited into the molds.
And his mixer really looks like a power drill at an industrial scale. It really does.
Yeah. It's a pretty heavy-duty piece of equipment for him, that's for sure. But it gets the job done, and it gets that salt mixed in well. So once the bars are deposited, they go through these cooling tunnels, and it takes about 30 minutes for the mold to make it from the depositor to where we're going to walk down here and see how it gets conveyed out to our wrapper.
Okay, well, since this is radio, I need to describe a little bit. So it's a big room with a lot of stainless steel. There's some vats in the back, and then there's some, I guess you said these are coolers, stainless steel boxes with lots of pipes and cords and things going up to the ceiling. And then we've got a conveyor belt that's coming around, and I see a stack of chocolate bars in front of a couple of people who are in front of, is that the packaging?
Right,
machine,
so
they're
the
about
wrapper.
To the wrapper, okay. And it smells very richly of chocolate in here. About how many people are on a shift?
So Endangered Species Chocolate has a total of 45 employees. 14 of those employees are front office staff, and then 31 of them are working here in production and warehousing.
And I guess it also is gonna matter what temperatures it's stored at through the whole cycle of getting it into the store.
Right, so that's another critical piece of our puzzle that we require all of our transit services to keep our product at a controlled temperature.
Yeah, okay.
Go this way.
Okay.
That was it for my tour of the chocolate factory. I didn't get to swim in a chocolate river, but I did learn a lot about how to make a premium fair trade chocolate bar. You can learn about Endangered Species Chocolate Company's conservation efforts and more at chocolatebar.com or find a link on our website, eartheats.org. We'll leave the chocolate making to the experts, but if you want to whip up something decadent yet simple for your sweetheart this Valentine's Day, look no further than Susan Mintert's Crazy Chocolate Cake. This type of cake recipe came about during the Depression, when rich ingredients like eggs and butter might be hard to come by. It might sound humble, but it hits all the notes you're looking for in a chocolate dessert.
This cake consists of flour, cocoa powder, sugar, salt, and soda, for your dry ingredients, and then you're going to add some vanilla, some vinegar, and some salad oil, and then 2 cups of water. So those are the ingredients, and we're just going to put this together. You mix it all up in your baking pan. So I have just a 9x13 baking pan here, and we're going to put all the ingredients in the pan, and we are going to mix it up and then bake it. So it's just as easy as that. So we've combined all the dry ingredients into our baking pan, and we're going to just thoroughly mix those together. I like to use a flat wire whisk. It works really well for this. You can also use a fork. This is the only part of this cake that even takes very long. So, now, this is kind of the fun part. When you get this mixed together, make three wells in the dry ingredients here. Into the first well, we're going to put 2 teaspoons of vanilla. Into the second well, 2 teaspoons of vinegar. And into the third well, we're pouring in a scant 2/3 cup of oil. And I always use canola oil. On the top of this, we're going to pour over 2 cups of cold water. So we're just going to kind of pour this over the top. And you want to be careful here so you don't splatter. And then we're going to take that whisk again and just whisk it together. All right, so we've just about got this, and you know, it's not going to be perfect, like without lumps, but you do want to get all the dry ingredients well incorporated and get that oil mixed in. Our oven is preheated to 375. Okay.
So the leavening agent of this cake is baking soda, right? So that's reacting with vinegar, right, probably?
Yes. The baking soda with the acid would create the bubbles and therefore the leavening.
There are some little tiny bubbles in there.
Already, yeah. Already some bubbles, that's right. So we've got it ready. We're going into the oven, and it only takes 30 minutes to bake. We'll have dessert in no time. The other thing about this cake, which we didn't really comment on, but we mixed all the ingredients in the baking pan, and the baking pan was not greased or floured ahead of time, nothing at all. It was ungreased. It works. It will come out of the pan when it's done, so we'll see how it comes out.
The cake bakes for about 30 minutes in a 375 degree oven, but don't worry about writing it all down. This recipe can be found on our website, eartheats.org.
So our cake has been out of the oven now for a couple hours. We have it served with strawberries with a little sugar and a dollop of creme fraiche on the side. Cake has a nice texture. It's nice and moist.
Does.
And the creme fraiche gives you a little of that creamy element, but it's not too sweet.
Yeah, it's not sweet, really.
Yeah. All right, I think it's a keeper.
That was Susan Mintert in the kitchen with her mom and her daughter. Susan Mintert is the host of the Indiana Home Cooks podcast, and she's a home cook herself. Find more wherever you get your podcasts or at indianahomecooks.com. That's all we have time for today. I'm Kate Young, and thanks for listening to Earth Eats. And thanks to everyone who helps with the show, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Hans Thayer, Kyle Friend, Whitney Bembenick, and Susan Mintert. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. We'll be back next week. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers, offering teas and signature drinks like the Hilltopper, located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com.